Hello, and welcome to Wind Down, Build Up, the podcast giving you the tea and the tools to succeed in business. I'm Tabitha Solomon.
And I'm KJ Miller. Today on the show, we are talking all about business school, because as many of you know, Tabs and I graduated from Harvard Business School in 2014. And, you know, I think we learned a little bit while we were there, a little bit we can share.
Absolutely. That is absolutely right. And you know what? I know not everyone wants to spend $150,000 to $200,000 or 2 years of your life on an MBA before jumping into a startup idea. So we're going to run down some of our biggest lessons learned while we were at HBS.
Yes, at least the ones we can remember. And before we jump in, we just want to encourage you to pause real quick and follow us if you're listening on Spotify, and leave us a 5-star review if you're listening on Apple. Okay, so this week for the tea, I was thinking we could both share just, you know, a personal, maybe a juicy story from B-School, something we don't mind sharing. Now, I will jump off. I'll kick off with a little personal story, which is, as you know, at HBS, and I think this is true at a lot of different business schools, at HBS, we have sections our first year. And your section is, you take all of your classes with your section. At HBS, the sections are about 90 people. And they're almost like little communities, because not only do you take all of your classes together, but you have a lot of events together. You know, you do section dinners and section lunches. It's like meant to be sort of like a way to give you some sort of community at a very big school. So anyway, along with it being a family and a community and blah, 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 there are also board roles. So there's a president of the section, there's social chairs of the section, there's a treasurer of the section. And so I decided to run for president of the section. And I don't really know what inspired me to do this, because honestly, looking back, I mean, I had a good experience, but like, it's just a lot of work, you know, and like business school, yes, you're there to learn, but you're also there to have fun. So I'm not entirely sure what inspired me to do this, but I ran for president. And one of the things that happened, I'm not going to call anybody out by name, okay? But I will say this. I will say part of the reason I ran for president was because like we had planned things as a section before elections even happened. And I had taken a pretty big role in planning our section retreat. And so it just sort of seemed, I guess, kind of natural after that, that I would, you know, run for president. Okay, so I did. I'm not thinking about it as if it's like this hugely important thing. I'm thinking about it more like, all right, like I've gotten to know a good number of people in the section. I feel like I've got a good pulse on the sort of community people want to build. Like, okay, but in my mind, this is not a big deal. Certainly not anything to lose any sleep over. Okay, now another person in the section who is also running decides to pull me aside one day. She asks me, can we go to lunch? And I had spoken with her. I'd met her. I didn't know her that well. And I was like, yeah, absolutely. Like, let's get lunch. So we get lunch and she says to me, like, we're sort of talking and getting to know each other, whatever. But then she ends by saying, basically, she's like, you know what, KJ? I think you're so good with people and like, you know, you just have such an infectious personality. You would make a really great social chair. And like at this, like, but we had already announced both of us that we were running for president. Like we, like that was known, right? Like, and so this girl was basically just telling me like, you should stop running for president and you should run for social chair. And I remember just being like, this feels so quintessentially like an HBS thing to do. Like all of the stereotypes about Harvard and Harvard people and Harvard types, whatever you've heard, to me, when this girl said this to me, I was like, oh, this is what people mean when they talk shit about Harvard. Like, they mean this, you know, because like you're taking this so seriously, and now you're trying to, like, I don't know, like brain warp me into wanting this this other thing. It just was so bizarre. I like, I don't even remember how I responded. I think I was just like, huh, okay, yeah, all right, and then just like went on about my business, and then did run for president, and then did win president. So like, hey, but like, it just was so, I don't know, it just was one of those things I'll never forget, because I was so caught off guard by it, you
Yeah,
know?
absolutely. You know what's crazy about that story, KJ, is the exact same thing happened to me. Like, it's eerie to hear another Black woman share that story, because I have almost never told this story outside of my immediate, family and maybe like my two best friends. But I too was like, okay, like I was like, I'm gonna run for our section president. Similar concept. I was really involved in our section early on. And there was a young girl or woman, excuse me, in our section who was like really shy, but she had a lot of responsibility around coordinating the sports. She was really passionate about getting people together for sports, but she hated like the talking portion. She's like, Tabitha, you talk a lot. Like, and people seem to listen. So, can you make an announcement after class today that we have signups open and we need people to sign up? And here's your sheet. I was like, of course, I got you, girl. So after class, I was like, hey guys, quick announcement. Our girl CC here has a sheet. Make sure you sign up. It's gonna be an awesome time. So similar to you, I'm not gonna share this person's name. I'm gonna call her Karen. So Karen comes up to me after making that 30-second announcement and was like, excuse me, as you know, you are not allowed to promote or to campaign when running for section president. I would deem what you just did to be considered promoting, and I need it to stop. And I was like, who the hell? Who the hell
What?
is she talking to? And I remember just looking stunned and feeling stunned and just like lost for words. And I was like, okay. And I just packed my stuff up and left. But you know what? It's similar to you. I was thinking, damn, this is the ugly side of Harvard. Because until that point, my section mates really made it a point to make me feel welcome. I did the same. I was still struggling to find my place in the section. But like that moment was actually defining for me my first year at HBS, because I left thinking that she didn't like me. Other people in the section probably didn't like me. I didn't know they respect me, because like, if you respect me, would you talk to me that way? And funny enough, that same week I had she and someone else came up to me and was like, we really think that, based off how bubbly and cheerful and sweet and fun you are, you would be awesome as social chair. And I was like, first, you told me not to campaign and try to put me in my place. Second, you're trying to push me into another role. So like, I wish I had a triumphant story like you, where you came out on top and you won your second president. I actually retreated in that moment, and I'm not proud to say it. I'm actually like, in hindsight, I'm like, gosh, I wish I would have had the courage to be like, girl, sit your ass down. Like, I was not campaigning. I'm just making an announcement for my girl over here, But I didn't have that courage at that point, because I was looking for my place. And so, now I look back and I'm like, oh my God, I found my voice. I have so much strength. I know my purpose on this planet. At that time, I was trying to find myself. And so, that's my little juicy story. And again, when you're sharing your story, it reminds me again why Kamala Harris is so important. Our section ended up getting a white guy as our section president, even though almost everyone was a diverse candidate but him. And so, and respect, like, he did a great job. He's a cool dude, he's an amazing father, And Craig, shout out Craig Kessler, he's a phenomenal leader. He was like, Tabitha, we have to do this auction. He was like, I have to pick someone from the section and do it. Any way I can get you to do it. And I was like, for you, Craig, I'll do it. And, you know, we were the first section to actually pull it off. We did a 5-star hotel. We raised like a record amount of money. I remember afterwards, she's like, Tabitha, I can't convince anyone to do shit for me. How did you convince a group of people to pull off like this record-breaking event? And I was like, oh, well, I have a very specific leadership style that gets people to get things done. And, you know, I broke it down. He was like, I don't do any of that stuff. And I was like, we just have different styles. That's all it is.
Right.
And I think we both had that moment where we're looking at each other like, huh, you know, I wonder if people had seen people like me in that position before, they would have been as dismissive. Because when you think about Black people, it's like, oh, we think about Michael Jordan and we think about Beyonce. We think about artists and we think about, you know, creatives. We rarely think about politicians, presidents. We rarely think about successful business people. And that's another reason why I just love our podcast, is because we're trying to shift that paradigm and let people know there are successful Black business and Black female business owners out there who are carving our own path, even against all resistance and all odds.
Amen. Yes. I love it. And I just, it's so funny because now obviously we're grown and business school is several years removed. And so it's funny to think about how things like that really did affect us in those moments, but they really did, you know, like in so many ways, when you got to business school, that section was like your little family, you know, because you spent all of your time with them. And Harvard is such a big school that like, it's impossible to get to know everyone. So you sort of like quickly try and figure out, okay, in my section, who are going to be my close friends, and everything just feels like it matters so much. So for that to be a part of both of our first experiences in those first few weeks is really interesting. And I think speaks to the type of aggressions and microaggressions that Black people, and particularly Black leaders, face all of the time. So really interesting.
Yeah, I didn't know that happened to you to too. How about that?
Yeah, I know. I didn't know that about you either. Well, there you have it, folks. That's
that
the tea.
Is the tea.
So...
It was sipping hot today.
That is the tea. So should we get into the
Absolutely.
Tools?
Let's do it.
Okay. So look, for the tools this week, what I thought we'd do is sort of just go either, you know, through some of our takeaways from some of our classes that we had to take, and some of the cases we had to read, just the ones that really stood out in our minds. And I know, as I was sort of going through this exercise, I realized how little I remember from, I mean, we read like 500 cases while we were in business school. You would think like more of them would have stuck with me, but there were a lot that I forgot. However, there are some things that I do remember, starting with, we have a class called the Operational Manager. You take that your first year. And one of the most famous cases in that class is about Benihana's, the restaurant. So I'm sure you remember this because this truly is a pretty famous business school case, Harvard Business School case. And basically, like, you, what you do in a case study is you read about whatever the business is or whoever the case protagonist is who's, you know, running the business or managing or whatever. And then you try and sort of break down why certain things worked. What is it about the strategy? What is it about the operations, or why certain things didn't work? You know, what did this person fail to do as a leader? So on and so forth. And so in the Benihana case, you're really looking at, you know, they sort of revolutionized in a lot of ways the restaurant industry. They did so many things that restaurants before them weren't doing. And they made so many strategic and operational choices that led to some really great outcomes for them for a long time. And so, you know, this is one of those cases that stuck with me because there were just so many of these like great takeaways, you know. So what were some of the things that we feel like we learned from this case in particular?
So one is thinking about what is the traditional restaurant experience versus the Benihana experience and flow. So for a moment, you know, for me, another tea moment is I actually worked as a waitress at Red Lobster.
I didn't know that.
Cheddar Bay biscuits are delicious for 2.5 years. And so we'll use that as an example, right? So the traditional restaurant, like a Red Lobster, your guests will come, they'll be greeted by a host, and there might be 30 minutes, an hour wait. And what are you doing during that time? You're on your cell phone in the waiting area until a table is clear, and then you get sat down. Once you sit down at that table, you'll have a waiter who come, will greet you, and it'll be back and forth ping-ponging between what do you want to order, putting into the system, going back to the kitchen, picking it up, bringing it to your repeat, your appetizer, your main course, your dessert, and then bringing out your check, and then you leave.
There's a lot of downtime in that model.
And it's not the most efficient, right? Because if you think about it, each person has their own table. So like you have to be spaced out, which works in the pandemic era. But like beyond this period, like that takes a lot of space. Also the kitchen, because there's only a ton of chefs or cooks in the background. You need a ton of long. And so a menu can have sometimes hundreds of different combinations. Now, for the Benihana, let's talk about that process flow. The customer enters a restaurant and maybe there is a wait because you're sat in batches of groups. Instead of you just sitting and looking at your phone, what they do is they direct you into the lounge bar area. And so this is a social setting where you're going to buy a drink, probably a cocktail drink. When the table is ready for your batch of, let's say, 20 people, you are all sat at the same time. After you sat at the restaurant, you might have your drink order, but then your chef not only knows your order because it was placed in advance, they have the right amount of food and portions already selected on that cart. It is cooked. Your cook is also your chef and your entertainment and your server because he serves the food in front of you. When it's all said and done, you all leave at the same time. So one, you don't need as much kitchen space in the background because the cooking is done right in front of you. Okay. Two, you don't have as much waste on your food because there's only a limited amount of things you can choose from. And there's like a mix and match option. And we know exactly what portion you have. So you're not like a buffet where you have all this food that you throw out or waste at the end of the night. Three, you're having way more drink orders than you would have because people are actively like socializing as part of the experience. And so by fundamentally changing, you know, the entire flow from a Red Lobster experience in this example to a Benihana experience, you've drastically increased the customer experience, improve your operations, and improve your operational cost.
Yep. Well, first of all, that was beautifully laid out, Tabitha. I just want to say I was taken back to business school. Cold in call. That moment. So very well done. Yes. Immaculate cold call. But yes, exactly that. And you know what? One of the reasons I think they open up with this case, because this might be the first case you do in Tom, if I'm not mistaken. One of the reasons they open up with this, I think, is because like it's supposed to get you thinking in the mindset of how can you fundamentally rethink traditional industries, traditional modes of operation to make a process much more efficient, to make a process much more profitable. And it really does get your juices flowing. And I just remember the first time going through this case, by the end of that class, I was just like, oh, snaps. Like, I'm about to be out here disrupting every industry. You're not gonna be able to tell me nothing. And you feel so inspired by the end of it. So, you know, I think the hope with that case and our hope in sharing it with you guys is simply to say, you know, there are always opportunities to look at what is done, what is considered traditional, what is considered the norm, and then to kind of blow that up. You know, like it gets really easy to think like, because this is the way something has always been done, this is the way we're going to continue doing it. But it doesn't have to be that way. And I think the most successful startups start with the question of like, well, why does it have to be this way? You know, and certainly in the case of Benihana, they completely flipped the restaurant industry on its head. You know, they said, we're not going to give you unlimited options. You can choose between chicken, shrimp, or steak. You know, like, and do you want your rice fried or not fried? And those are basically your options, you know, like, and we're going to entertain you. But the way we're going to entertain you is literally by standing here and cooking in front of you. You know, like, I just, they rethought so many things. And obviously the case is much more eloquently stated than all of that. But yeah, I think it's just meant to get you thinking from the perspective of what if we turned this whole thing on its head. So I just remember that is a case really enjoying. All right, so up next, I was thinking marketing, another case you take your first year. And at HBS in particular, we have a professor, or had a professor named Michael Porter. And he was very famous because he came up with Porter's Five Forces, which is basically an industry analysis that's supposed to help you kind of understand and identify an industry's structure, and whether or not it would make sense to enter that industry, or how to think about that industry as you're examining or analyzing a company. So, excuse me, these five forces have become pretty famous, and now it's been several decades since he came up with it. So there are other ways that people think about industry analysis outside of this, but this is something that sort of originated by this professor at Harvard Business School, and definitely something that we talked through a lot at HBS. So, you know, I think it's worth going through the five forces and sort of talking through them. So the first is competition, right? Like, what is competition like in the industry? So let's take, for instance, beauty, just because it's an industry I know well. If you were thinking about getting into the beauty industry, and the first thing you looked at is competition, you might say to yourself, okay, it's incredibly competitive. There are just thousands of beauty brands out there. And that's true. It's an extremely competitive industry that might make you less likely to want to get in. The second of the five forces is potential of new entrants into the industry. Well, when you think about it from that perspective, you might say, hey, it looks like the potential to enter and the barrier to enter is pretty low, because look at all these people who've already done it. So that might actually make you more likely to want to get into the industry, because clearly a lot of people have done it. A lot of people can do it. The third of the five forces is the power of suppliers. So by this, we mean, you know, are there just a few manufacturers, a few suppliers who make the things that you would need, who supply the raw ingredients that would create your beauty products? If so, they're going to have a ton of power, right? Like, if there are only two people who supply the colorants that you might need to make your lipsticks, they can charge essentially whatever the hell they want, because there's just two of them and there's no other game in town. But if there are dozens and dozens of suppliers, now all of a sudden the competition amongst them means that you as a customer have a lot of power, right? So that might make you more likely to want to get into this industry. The fourth one is power of customers. So in that sense, you're thinking about your end customer. How much power do they have? Do they have like a ton of choice, in which case they can drop you in a minute? Or do they have, you know, very limited choice, in which case they're going to be more loyal, and once you get them, they're very, very sticky. And then finally, the threat of substitute products. That's the fifth force. So basically, how easy is it for someone to come up with a product that either completely replaces you or acts like a substitute to what your product does? And in the case of beauty, the answer is it's pretty easy, right? It's not that hard to make another lipstick. It's not that hard to make another blush. So that could be another reason why you might think to yourself, okay, not sure if this is the industry for me. So those are the five forces. And that's just a quick read of, you know, how you might think about it from the perspective of one industry.
So, and by the way, this is something I learned in undergrad at the University of North Florida when I was getting my I got a marketing and a business administration degree. I got two degrees. And this is actually strategy, not marketing. But I remember learning this as like the North Star, the gold standard for strategy decisions. And it was pretty cool to then go to the business school where like this, the professor there came up with a concept, you know, so super cool. What I would add is just, so taking the examples of the five forces we went over, like maybe some things that aren't obvious, right? So like, for instance, if you hear there's a lot of competition in the industry, I think your initial gut reaction would say, well, I shouldn't go there. Now, the question I would pose instead is like, do you know how you'd be able to stand out from everyone else, right? So for instance, if there is a lot of car manufacturers and you're able to come up with an electric vehicle that's able to run off like 1,000 miles before it needs to be recharged, you might consider going into that industry because you know how to break away from the competition and provide a unique value proposition, potential of new entrants into the industry. So here again, the ideal scenario is like going somewhere where it's not easy for other people to get into your industry, but sometimes you have to create your own moat. And that could be around branding. It could be around having patents, things of that sort. So if you're vertically integrated in the example of EV and you're able to create a electric vehicle and you're the one creating the battery and you're able to put a patent to that, now it's going to be harder for people to get into that space with you. And then, you know, if we're talking about power of suppliers, so sometimes this is really the argument where you see a lot of brands who were going off to China and buying the different pieces and components before and saying like, this is not working for us. We now have to vertically integrate so we don't have this issue. Sometimes you have to think about like, is it worth me investing in building out the entire vertical integration myself? I believe it was Peloton, if I'm not mistaken, who couldn't keep up with demand because they couldn't get the parts they needed fast enough to get the bikes, if I'm not mistaken. And if I'm not mistaken, their competitor was like, well, I see this as an opportunity. So we're going to go ahead and create this from the bottom up. And so they control the entire experience. And then power of customers. So again, the least amount of customers you have, the worse it is for you in most instances, because like, if you have one big client, you're like, man, I got a client, they pay me $1 million a year to do fill in the blank. And you think that's awesome. But the problem is, what if that client decides they don't want to work with you anymore next year? They were able to get a better deal from someone else. Like, you're not protecting yourself in that situation. So there's an argument on why you want to try to have, you know, not have more than 20% was like the rule I was taught. Like, no one customer should be more than 20% of my sales revenue. So that way no one ever has too much control over your growth. And then that threats of substitute. And so here in this example of EV electric vehicles, you know, you might say like, oh, well, there's not that many electric vehicles out there. There's like NIO and XPeng in China and, you know, everyone's trying to jump in, but a lot of times people don't realize, well, maybe people are going to switch to scooters. Maybe people will switch to electric bikes, you know, because they're moving towards healthier lifestyles. Maybe they'll move to, you know, electric motorcycles. There are things that may be not even like in your peripheral because you didn't consider them competitors, but they could be substitute. And so as a prudent business leader, you're thinking about all of these forces, because if you take your eyes off of any one of these, another one may pop up and be what inevitably disrupts your business. So that's the important thing about all. So it's not like pick one force and like try to nail it. It's you have to keep your eye on all five to remain competitive in the marketplace.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting because I very distinctly remember learning about Porter's five forces in marketing. But it is strategy.
Oh, interesting.
So we talked about it in both courses, and that's why. Because I remember like having a conversation about it.
Oh, wow. And I remember having this conversation with my strategy professor.
But no, I think it is. I mean, Michael Porter was known as economist and business strategy professor. So it makes sense. I think it is strategy more so. I just distinctly remember. I think that's why it's sort of burned in my mind as marketing.
Like,
but yeah,
marketing, you have to think about your positioning, right? In the marketplace and your value proposition. So if you don't know who your competitors are, if you don't know what the substitutes are, et cetera, you can't really have a really good marketing positioning. So it makes sense why that would be relevant in that course too.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so finally, I thought we could talk a little bit about LEAD. LEAD was actually my favorite class our first year. I just loved that LEAD was all about like the people, you know? And one thing I've learned about myself as a leader is like, I tend to spend the most amount of my time thinking about the people stuff. You know, the numbers and the strategy, all of that is really important. And sometimes that keeps me up.
Yeah.
But generally, the stuff that keeps me up is the people stuff. And so I remember loving that every class we got to look at a different person, a different business owner, manager, director, whomever it was, and really think about the problems they were facing or the things they were trying to accomplish from their perspective. And I remember really enjoying that. But I think one case that sticks out probably for everyone is a case, and I think we've actually talked about this a little bit on a prior episode, is a case where essentially, depending on what section you're in or what year you're reading the case, the HBS publishing team switches out whether the protagonist in the case is a man or a woman. So like either it's Harry or Heidi, or it's, you know, Steve or Susan, but whomever, they change out the name and so that they can get an understanding of like, what does the discussion look like when we're talking about a male case protagonist versus when we're talking about a female case protagonist. And essentially what they have discovered over many, many, because I forget exactly what company the person works at. It may have been a fictional company, honestly. Okay, venture capitalist. And essentially, this person is like really gung-ho, like a go-getter, like get it done, super ambitious, network your way to the top, you know, like just, you know, a really go-getter type of person. And essentially what they found over several years of teaching the case was that when the case protagonist was presented as a man, people applauded that about him. They applauded that he was incredibly ambitious, applauded, you know, whatever tactics he used to get in the room and to get the network, to get it done. But when the protagonist was a woman, people essentially said she is too aggressive and that's going to turn people off. People aren't going to want to work with her. You know, she needs to pull it back, basically. But nothing about the case would change except for the name of the protagonist. So I remember just, you know, when we finally read that case and that was revealed to us, you know, sort of all being like, oh, wow, yeah. and it got to this idea that women so often in the workplace cannot be viewed as both warm and competent. They can be seen as one or the other, but almost never both. And it's something that women get penalized for, because if you're overly competent and you're getting your shit done, then people are going to call you cold. They're going to call you a bitch. They're going to call you aggressive. If you're super warm and nurturing and kind and bubbly, then people are going to say, she can handle the social stuff and she can make sure that we have our weekly happy hours, but she can't be promoted because she doesn't, you know, she doesn't have what it takes. Well, there you go. So, yeah, I just remember, I think that was sort of a landmark case for a lot of us, because we sort of all were like, oh, yes, I have.
And you know what? The funny thing about it is, whether it was a woman student or a male student, female or a male student, the reactions were the same. It wasn't like women were nicer to Heidi and men were meaner. No, it was all men and women were nicer to the guy, and all men and women, or most, excuse me, I shouldn't use the word all, were meaner to Heidi. And so I think what that case is really trying to do is having us check our biases, you know, because sometimes we have unconscious biases that we're not even aware that we have ourselves. We like to think because we're women and we're progressive and we're business leaders that we wouldn't look at Heidi that way. But there's 40% of students at HBS who are women who did treat Heidi that way, you know? And then thinking about, like, if you're doing that for Heidi in this case, what are you doing when that Asian person is sitting in front of you in that workforce? Are you treating them like they can't be a leader because they're you know, soft spoken, you know, and they're an introverted leader? You know, what are you doing to that Black coworker? Are you assuming that they're only strong enough to be an individual contributor and not able to lead a team? Like, so we start off this case where we're thinking about gender biases, but it really creeps into just leaders in general, you know, and what are our unconscious biases that are driving us to make decisions and treat people certain ways, even though we're not aware of it. And so I love this case because it really got a dialogue going, you know, about like, wait, if I do this mm-hmm. for this sector, maybe I need to be more introspective of how this might be showing up in other sectors and other people that I work with. So I hope that people didn't just walk away with a feel good moment, oh man, what a cool case. But I hope, you know, both people who are listening to our conversation now and people who were in those classes with us, who are now like global business leaders of large units across the world, remember that lesson, you know, and remember that that ambitious woman can yeah. also be kind and nurturing and being a phenomenal leader.
Absolutely. Completely agree. Whew. All right. Well, I think we did a pretty bang up job of walking down the memory lane of business school and giving some of our key takeaways. And look, you know, this isn't about trying to convince anyone not to go yeah. to business school. We both had great experiences. I think there's a lot to learn. And of course, it's not just what you learn in the case studies Absolutely. And in the classrooms. It's the connections you make and the network that you build. So we're not trying to convince anyone not to do it. We just wanted to have a little bit of fun and take you guys through some yeah. of what we learned
well,
while
guys,
we were
that's
there.
It for this week. If you're loving the show, stop right now. Make sure you're subscribed and you've given us a 5-star rating. And be sure to tell a friend.
Absolutely. And if there is a topic you'd love to hear more about, be sure to send us an email at winddownbuildup@gmail.com.
Cheers.
Until next time.